Live from beyond the Beltway, this is Bruce Dumont with our weekly analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Todd Benzman, immigration investigator and author of Overrun, How Joe Biden Unleashed the Greatest Border Crisis in U.S. History. You certainly know where he's coming from. Ted Dabrowski joins us, conservative activist and president of Wire Points. Peter Hanna, a professor and materialist from Chicago Kent College of Law, and Republican commentator Stephanie Hitt. Our program tonight coming to you from home base at AM 560, The Answer, just outside Chicago in Elk Grove Village. Nice to have you with us. Phone lines open, 1-800-723-8289. We will be talking about illegal immigration and most importantly, its impact on cities all over the United States. And we'll talk about that in the second hour, primarily in our broadcast this evening. But we've got lots of other things to talk about as well, including one of the other big issues from Washington, D.C. is, I think, probably the annual discussion about whether or not there's going to be a shutdown or not. So, Ted Dabrowski, I want to start with you because you you have great financial credentials in your background. What if the government shut down? How quickly would we know it and how bad would it be?
Bruce, you know, we talked about it a little bit beforehand. I'm so sick of this discussion because it just happens year after year after year that there's no credibility with these shutdowns. It's always a warning. You know, back in the day, we're just talking about this. Ronald Reagan shut down the government eight times. That was back when we kind of took finances seriously. But, you know, at the national level, well, at the state level as well, finances mean nothing anymore. They print money. They borrow money. They don't tell the truth. So they can shut down the government for a little while. To me, it doesn't matter. You know, there'll be a lot of noise about downgrades and us not paying our debts, but it'll all be taken care of. It'll be taken care of. So I'm sorry. I can't jump up and down.
Stephanie, I want to get your reaction, another conservative perspective. You join us from the great Commonwealth of Virginia, but you're sitting right across from me this evening. Your reaction, what's good or bad about it?
I think the lead up to it is what's so bad. I mean, we go through this, couple times a year now, every time there's a budget time. What people don't understand is while there's all these threats and it all comes down to whoever's crying, you know, the sky is falling the most is going to be the party that thinks that somehow it's going to affect the perception of them. And that's what it's really about it comes down to who's going to be blamed for it. And eventually somebody's going to come up and step up and fix the problem. Right now, Congress is even doing that right now. They've got several appropriations bills all lined up, ready to go. So even if it happened, it would happen for a day. It would be one headline and we'd move on.
Peter Hanna joins us. He is from Chicago Kent College of Law, and he's been on this program for well over 10 years. He began by being described as a Democrat. Then he was a progressive. Then he was a leftist, and today he wants to be described as a materialist. But you're the closest thing to what might be described as a Democrat, at least in our first hour tonight. So, Peter, I think you may agree with everybody here is that this is a good example that Republicans and Democrats really don't get along and they don't plan anything well.
Well, I agree with both the guests. I would just specify that I never agreed to be identified as a Democrat, and I take that as an insult. But I do agree, especially with the way Ted put it, money doesn't mean really anything. The government can just arbitrarily say, here's $2 trillion more dollars. I mean, it really materialist is probably the best way I could describe myself because, I mean, I really want to focus on the economics, the actual resources, what's actually occurring. The only thing I'll add is, you know, the whole shutdown meaning anything is kind of a farce when, you know, like the Pentagon can just self-exempt from the government shutdown. So it really shows what a farce this entire exercise is and how both parties are just, you know, playing with fire.
Now, when the primary season comes along, Peter, do you not vote anymore or did you ever vote?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, voting is a decision that everyone obviously has to make. And I think when people get together and, you know, numbers and vote, they can obviously express their will. But, you know, at the end of the day, I don't see, you know, much change regardless of the party in power in the material circumstances of most Americans. I think overall, you know, the people's quality of life, their wages, everything, the hours they work, everything has kind of trended in a downward direction for more and more people, while costs have skyrocketed. So I don't really know, you know, it's very hard to tie some of the promises people in both parties make to the actual conditions that we find ourselves in.
From your perspective, then I want to get a reaction from our other more conservative guests. What, in your view, Peter, is the single most important issue in the country today?
I think the single most important issue is the fact that the country, as such, has pretty much ceded control of almost all of its institutions to the private sector across the board. The government, really, as it exists, seems completely in the thrall of the private sector, although it's, you know, conveniently blamed, right? You have the Democrats blaming the Republicans when they're in power, and the Republicans blaming the Democrats when they're in power. When at the end of the day, it's just tons and tons of resources are being wasted through corruption that kind of cuts through this entire apparatus we call the government. So I think getting, you know, the actual control back in the government, in the public's hands, and honoring the public's will, I think that's the biggest issue.
Ted, do you agree with any of that?
You know, in some ways I might, and in some others I don't. But, you know, I go a little bit more structural. I mean, of course, you know, things like what matters most right now, maybe it's the border, right? We're just letting people come in, and God knows how that's going to change America. But that's like – that's a current thing. I'd go more structural, and I'd say that for me, the biggest thing is the bastardization of the individual. The individual doesn't matter anymore. It's just the identity politics and the groupthink where the individual doesn't matter. And when we destroy the value of the individual, America's gone. And so I'd like to see, you know, things like free speech, all those things come back to importance, because right now they're being really attacked.
Stephanie?
I would, you know, it's interesting. My first response in listening to Peter was to say, actually, we can tie specific policies to the condition of people's lives today. I mean, people are feeling the effects of inflation when they go to the grocery store and things like that. And those can be directly tied to specific, you know, government actions and individuals. But I think the biggest problem in politics today is that general feeling that people don't feel like they can make a difference. And that it doesn't seem to matter, that the people are in Washington are so disconnected to what matters to everyday people's lives that it doesn't matter. It's like we're working in two parallel universes, the political world and then the everyday world. People don't feel no connection.
That fly in the face, however, of the growing movement of people to become more involved in school boards? I mean, that's been a key issue for you even before you moved to Virginia.
But there's a difference between local politics and national politics, and that is huge. And I think people feel like the only place they can make a difference is in their own block, and that's it, nowhere else.
Yeah, and Bruce, if I may say, people might be trying to do things at the local level, but the more they get centralized, the more that gets centralized at the state level or D.C., and laws and rules and policies are coming down from the top, the power down at the bottom is really, really gone.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8289. That's the phone number. I'm Bruce Dumont. This is Beyond the Beltway. Thanks for joining us tonight. Back, we continue with Beyond the Beltway. If you watched Meet the Press today with Christian Welker, they released the latest NBC news poll. And one thing that I found very interesting on the issue of should Joe Biden run again, there was kind of a devastating response, I think. And in that poll, these are people that want a challenger to President Biden. 59% say they want a challenger to Joe Biden. 36% said no, and they didn't go much further in talking about Robert Kennedy Jr., but again, they want, I guess, another challenger other than Robert Kennedy Jr. And when you break down where voters are at the moment insofar as looking at the likelihood of Joe Biden being reelected, amongst black voters in 2021, he had 80% support. That's now down to 63%. That's a 17% drop just with black voters. So that is, by the way, even with Kamala Harris as a running mate, that's where that is. So you can imagine that if he should dump Kamala Harris, that number probably would go up insofar as lack of black support, I would think. Then if you look at the other key elements of what made him president over Donald Trump, were Latino voters. 61% of Latino voters in 2021 were for Joe Biden. That's now down to 43%, an 18% drop. For people with a high school diploma or less, it was 43%. It's now down to 26%. That's a 17% drop. And for independents, which I think is probably the key of all, it was 50% in 2021. And now it's 36%. That's a drop of 14%. So when you look at those numbers, I mean, they seem to be pretty devastating for the president. And Peter, I want to go to you again. You're not a Democrat. You don't like any of these labels. But I assume that you may hang around with some Democrats or progressives. And I'm just wondering, do any of them bring up the subject of the president? And is there anybody out there that within your sphere of influence that anybody is excited about Joe Biden?
Yeah, I think among the people that, you know, I talk to, there is no excitement about Joe Biden. I mean, even the people who were excited about Joe Biden in 2020, it wasn't so much that, wow, Joe Biden, wow, this is our chance finally to vote for a guy who plagiarized his way through, you know, multiple congressional runs. Like, no, it was just, this is the option that we have other than Donald Trump, who I think for 4 years, a lot of people, especially in like cities and urban environments, lost their minds over. So nobody looks at Joe Biden right now, especially with Trump, you know, endlessly indicted and, you know, their fingers crossed that one of these things will stick. This will be the time the walls really close in. You know, there is no enthusiasm or excitement at all. The only person I've seen any enthusiasm and any excitement for really has been Cornel West. Among the people, and Cornel West is obviously a very respected individual, Dr. Cornel West, with a lot of, you know, great ideas. But he kind of represents the, in my mind, like the spiritual successor of Bernie Sanders. Right. So there are still people coalescing around, you know, those sorts of ideas. But
those that coalesce around those ideas or coalesce around Cornel West, I mean, that's bad news for Joe Biden, because those are people that may have gone to Joe Biden. They're not going to go to Donald Trump.
Yeah.
But again, it's an important thing. I want to go to Stephanie to get her reaction from this. Do any of these statistics surprise you?
Not a single one surprises me. I don't know. I mean, and I do have Democrat friends, and they nobody is excited about him at all. And it's not just the age thing. It's everything, but it's some of the decision making that he's done. And I think there, from those that I thought, the few people that did like Joe Biden in 2020 and were actually pro Joe Biden, they did see him as a moderate. They did see him as someone who would calm the country, bring it together. They really did believe in that message. And we've seen the opposite happen. I mean, not only have we seen severe decline in the economy directly tied to his immediate policies, but, you know, it's also the way that he behaves, the way he talks, the way that he distances himself from the press. And at every chance he gets, all he does is go out and just decry MAGA Republicans are to blame. And people don't see that as a positive.
Ted, I want you to kind of look across the aisle here. I think if you're a political junkie or a professional political junkie, you could sit in a room with other like-minded viewers or thinkers and look at these polls and say, you know what, we got to do something. This guy can't make it. And then last week, David Ignatius came up with an idea, a very progressive journalist, came up with the idea that not only Joe Biden's got to go, Kamala Harris has got to go, the ticket's right. Got to go. So, and again, there was quite a bit of response to it because he's held in high esteem by many people left of center. But how do you get the attention of Joe Biden? What would you be saying to him, Ted, if your job was to convince him to bow out.
Or to bow out. Well, you know, there's the big theory that, you know, maybe he wants to stay in because he's got his own concerns about what he might be, you know, convicted or indicted for.
Mm-hmm.
He maintain his protections by being president? So, you know, that might give him the impetus to run again. But I don't think there's any convincing him to change. I don't think,
no.
You know, sadly, I think, you know, mentally he's not strong enough. I don't think there's convincing there. I think the question is, you know, for the party is, yeah, how do you get him out? And then who steps in? Is it, is it a Newsom? Is it a Pritzker? You know, we've watched Pritzker on the stump in Florida and in New Hampshire. He wants to run. I mean, he literally has made his campaign speeches. But it's tough.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that the other theory on the conservative side is, you know, it's not about Joe Biden. You know, Joe Biden is there because he is, you know, there's an apparatus behind him. And they're the ones that are going to run the party. They're the ones that are running the country. They're the ones running Democrat policy. And he makes for a great front man. And that's, you know,
But if his claim to fame is, I'm the guy that beat, you know, Donald Trump. And you look at that race now, it's even. It's even, Stephen.
Exactly. He didn't.
And by the way, we should mention this poll today said that Biden would be slightly ahead of DeSantis, but he would be behind Nikki Haley. Nikki Haley had the best one-on-one with Joe Biden. Right. I want to go to our law professor because I want you to put on your progressive – I wanted to put your professorial hat on, Peter.
You got it.
Share with us what you think of the four indictments that have been leveled against Donald Trump, and measure those against at least the growing evidence that seems to be coming out about some questionable activities between Joe Biden and his son Hunter. And I don't mean the gun license charge. I mean the charge of conspiracy to create criminal acts.
I can't speak to every single one, but what I can say pretty globally is that all of these indictments or these accused, you know, alleged crimes, you know, some are quite serious, tampering with, you know, interfering with the election. The Georgia RICO claims, so Georgia's RICO law, I will say, is known to be absurdly overbroad. You know, five people in a room, you know, who, you know, share a sandwich and share one sentence with each other about something that could be conceivably, called a crime or something, even a misdemeanor, could lead to liability. It's a very overbroad law, and it's actually being used to prosecute a bunch of protesters, environmental protesters in Georgia, who are protesting the development of Top City, basically accuse all of them, 61 people, with RICO terrorism-related charges, domestic terrorism. So I know from that case, and I know from Trump's case, that these charges are probably pretty overblown. But the bigger headline I want to share, Bruce, is Trump's crimes, even if you assume them to have occurred, pale in comparison to the crimes of pretty much every president, certainly the ones who came before him immediately. Barack Obama, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George Bush the First, Ronald Reagan. These are people who've candidly committed war crimes. So I find it interesting that, you know, what we can do is we could point to some of the relatively low-level crimes of Donald Trump, which you just simply lack the nuance and sort of sophistication to perform, you know, seamlessly, while we just overlook and give a pass to things that, I mean, look at Libya. I mean, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are responsible for turning Libya into a literal hellscape. And, you know, Barack Obama had the audacity to ask people to donate to his foundation. It's unbelievable. So
What about Biden? I'd like to delve more into that because I think that's a significant point that I think a lot of people listening would like to hear more about. But again, answer my question. We've got about a minute and a half left. Delve into the charges that are out there circulating regarding Joe Biden. Are you worried about those legally?
I mean, I'm not worried about any of this stuff. This is all, you know, as far as I'm concerned, a form of theater. But in terms of the actual substantive charges, when I look at them, yeah, I mean, I think there was a precedent probably set up with the last president that impeachment or talk of impeachment is now sort of in the political sort of wheelhouse of just back and forth, you know, political jockeying. So I'm not, you know, I'm sure there's probably some credit credibility to them. But I doubt that they're going to be sufficient to ever result in an actual removal. But yeah, I mean, candidly, when I look at Biden and I look at Hunter Biden, it's just kind of like a sideshow. And I look at Joe Biden and I feel bad. I don't see this guy as capable of being a criminal mastermind or even having the sort of mental cognitive state to, perpetrate a crime. But his actions probably did amount to some misdemeanor at some point. But yeah, it doesn't really trouble me.
Okay. When we come back, I want to get reaction from our guest in studio to that and the possibility of an impeachment inquiry. That's one of the major issues that members of Congress have to deal with very soon. And I want to hear from them whether they think the idea of impeaching Joe Biden on the eve of an election is a good idea. I'm Bruce Dumont. Don't go away. Went back, and we are at that point in our program, some say the most exciting part of our program, where we let each of our guests introduce themselves and describe themselves. We're going to begin with Ted Dabrowski. Ted?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, so I'm president of WirePoints, and I've been with WirePoints about, already 6 years. And, and at WirePoints, we're obsessed with trying to turn around Illinois. We're worried about, the path it's on. A lot of people are worried, not just us. This used to be the destination, a massive destination state, not just for the U.S., but for the whole world. It's a beacon of opportunity back in the 60s and before. And today, we are a shrinking state. We're just one of three states that shrunk last decade, West Virginia, Mississippi, and Illinois. So we're fighting hard to tell the truth. We're very data-obsessed about what's happening with the economy, with jobs, with crime, the migration stuff, all of it. We've got to expose the truth because nobody seems to want to really talk about the data and then the truth with that.
And 30 seconds more on WirePoint. Describe a little bit more of WirePoint.
Yeah, so what we do is we do research, policy, commentary. We aggregate news as well. And what we're out to do is to make sure people understand what the facts are. The traditional media won't cover most of what we cover, so we're trying to just get the truth out there.
Is it because the mainstream media doesn't cover it because they think it's too boring or they think your research is slanted one way or the other?
Well, I don't think it's slant. I think what they think is they can't go against the status quo. When Governor Pritzker, okay, Madigan, all those guys control everything, have controlled everything, and so they don't want to go against the status quo because they want to be invited to the parties.
Stephanie, introduction.
I am currently a political activist and commentator. I recently ran was campaign manager for the U.S. Senate campaign in Illinois,
Kathy
for United
Selby.
States. And before that, I was very active in local politics activism and including school issues involving school boards and changing the curriculum in schools. That's how I got to know Ted, mm-hmm, was through our efforts in fighting the DEI movements that are taking over the school boards across the country.
Do you have a preferred candidate for president?
I sure do.
Who?
I like Ron DeSantis.
You like Ron DeSantis?
He's the only guy that has actually done all the work. He knows how to implement principled conservative policies. He's not a populist. He's a conservative. And he's effective. He effectively has governed. He may not be the flashiest. He may not be the cutest. He may not, but he is the, he knows how to get the work done, mm-hmm, and he's done it effectively, and he's done it while garnering support and flipping a state from blue to red.
Okay. Peter Hanna, give us your extensive interview or introduction.
Oh,
there.
Wow, I won't be that extensive, but my name is Peter Hanna. I'm a lawyer. I practice in areas involving privacy, cybersecurity, and constitutional law with a focus on policing, habeas corpus. I've done a lot of appellate work. I'm very passionate about our rights as individuals and our development as a society and as a government.
You've said on this program that you and your parents don't get along. Is that still the case?
No, I've never said we don't get along.
Politically.
Yeah, what I have said is that we differ. No, I'm actually quite close with my parents and get along fantastically, and they're actually big fans of the show. But I think over the course of our lives, yeah, we've differed politically. But it's interesting, over the past, I would say, 5 or 6 years, there's been a much greater convergence across a lot of issues, because I think we, my parents, myself, and, you know, a lot of people I know, and your panelists, there are lots of people listening to this show now, are beginning to kind of like look beyond the kind of ideological baloney of people saying just like, I'm, you know, going to do this, I'm going to make America great, or no, we need to save democracy this way, and are seeing inflation take over, you know, their lives, and are seeing their jobs become tougher and their hours get harder. And they're asking, like, something is having this effect. And, you know, it is indeed policies that are having this effect. The point I made earlier is that people don't see how their votes for a policy translates into action around them. People are voting for things that they're not actually getting. And then some other people who end up in control seem to be imposing policy, not that people voted for or wanted, but that they just choose.
One of the things that you've been involved with, Ted, is the whole issue of economic equity. Because, as you said, the state of Illinois, the city of Chicago, many of the progressive cities of the United States, they've been, you know, playing this tune for the last 10-plus years. And you've delved into how equitable it is living in a large state or large city. And let you share your thoughts on that.
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating that the word equity has taken over Illinois, and it's taken over many parts of the country. But equity and, you know, the whole progressive notion of you know, progressive isn't good enough, right? Equity. And when you look at it, you think about Pritzker. He's a huge fan. You had Lightfoot. You know, if you look at their budgets, their speeches, equity's everywhere. And so I started saying, wait a minute, you know, they're obsessed about equity. They've been pushing this progressive push for decades. Let's look at how Illinois looks. And when you look at that, you would think based on that, we would be the most equity state in the country. Well, no. When you look at this, you know, Illinois is pathetic, right? Illinois' black unemployment rate, second highest in the country. You look at Florida, Alabama, much, much lower than ours. You look at the gap between black and white unemployment. We have the nation's highest gap in that.
It's wild.
So why are we so bad? If you look at the poverty rate, the gap between the white and black poverty rate, sixth worst in the country. You know, and I could go on. Household incomes were the third worst in the gap between black and white. What happened? You know, and all of America should know what we look like, because there's many people out there pushing the equity agenda. And all they need to do is look at Illinois, look at Chicago, and they'll understand what a failure it is.
Is that a failure of Republicans in Illinois who have failed to make the case? Because if all of your statistics are correct, and I don't challenge any of them because I don't have the facts.
And they're all Census Bureau. These are not our numbers. Yeah.
I mean, is it the Republicans can't articulate those positions, or is there something deeper than that, Peter?
Oh, there's definitely something deeper than that. I'm so glad Ted mentioned them, because what that really shows is whatever, you know, magic mumbo jumbo language you want to put on something, equity or whatever, the results are right there. So clearly what is actually being, you know, spent on, what policies are actually being backed, what programs are being backed, are not achieving the claimed or reported, you know, outcomes. So the reality is, I'm all for real economic equality, real economic justice, not whatever this is, which is ultimately, you know, some people putting money in one place and enriching some other people. Where's the beef, right? Like, you're claiming that you're investing in this stuff and the results aren't coming, so your policy is obviously not working, or we're missing something.
Or it's not true, right?
Well, you know, having spent some time out in the trenches of, you know, the actual on-the-ground grassroots politicking.
Door knocking.
The problem, especially in a place like Chicago, but we see it in a lot of cities and a lot of these urban centers, which basically are the tails that wag the tail of these other states. And that is, the fix is in. And, you know.
What fix?
The fix is in. The political system in this city, and so much of it is, people are not relating politics to the conditions on the ground and the conditions in their lives. They're not. And the, and what they're doing is they have a disassociation with, all right, here's someone in. I'm supposed to go out. I'm supposed to rally these people to come vote for these people. I'm driving these people to the polls. I'm doing this. The work of politicking, of campaigning, door knocking, getting people to the polls, that's the game in Chicago. You get those people to the polls, it doesn't matter what they're voting for, as long as they're voting for the group. And right now, that's Democrats. I don't even see a way in which a Republican, doesn't matter what they say, they can tie all of these, you know, all of the policies, they can do all the talking. A Republican cannot make a difference in these situations because we're not doing the work of getting people to vote a certain way. And in Chicago, that's what it's all about.
Peter, you had a comment on that, and then I know Ted does.
Yeah, just one brief comment. I mean, that's totally correct, but you know, in this binary system where the alternative is the Republican, no matter what, the Republican kind of carry the baggage of the entire party. Both parties are obviously awful. What this country badly needs is incredible third and fourth choices, like, because obviously what we've got are not cutting it at all.
Yes. Yeah, Bruce, you asked the question about whether Republicans bear some blame. And first, I would want to say that the Democrats bear the most blame because they have super majorities in Illinois.
Right,
they have
right.
been pushing this stuff and telling the story and effectively buying the votes.
Right.
And the poor voters think they're getting something, but they're not. But that said, the Republicans, I mean, this data is just standing there stark naked.
Right.
It's there.
Right.
You know, Chicago had the worst unemployment rate among all big cities in 2021. Why can't the Republicans make a case? And they haven't figured out. They don't know how to talk about this. They don't know how to present it. And they don't know how to defend it.
They don't know how to go into those neighborhoods either. That's another problem.
Well, they also don't have within the vast population of very wealthy Republicans, they don't have enough big spenders that are going to put their money where their mouth is so they can buy the television ads to make the case in a very entertaining and educational way to get these statistics out. Peter, you're shaking your head.
Yeah, there's no case. There's no case to make. I mean, the
what about those statistics?
Just one second. The Democrats only win because there manages to be a worse option. And to Americans, especially who live in cities, and I mean, just think about the people you interact with in a city. And then imagine a candidate who is allied with a party that manages to be worse than Democrats. It's like Democrats and also weird social issues, anti-gay, anti-abortion. There's nothing to sell. They will never win. There's no slick Hollywood production that could ever get them to win when they have that baggage.
Okay, we've got a pause. 1-800-723-8029. We'll talk more about this subject when we roll on, and we'll also talk about crime. From coast to coast. We have been monopolizing the conversation. We've got callers on the line. Let's go to John, listening to us in McHenry, Illinois. Go ahead. You're on the air, John.
Good evening. I just wanted to get back to the Washington Post ABC poll of y'all were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
And I have some real questions. First off, on just the polling in general showing, I mean, it just comes across as just blatant gaslighting. But getting back to the should President Biden be replaced, somehow, some way, I think California's Gavin Newsom is going to be replacing President Biden somewhere between now and the August convention in Chicago. And look what happened late last week. He vetoed a gender-affirming bill in California, and he's going to be at the candidates forum in Simi Valley to give the Democratic response to the Republican presidential candidates. But he's going to be there in person. So what do all of y'all think? I'm like Stephanie. I still like Governor Ron DeSantis. I don't believe the fake polls, and we're going to find out in January.
I think you're right, and the question is, it's a series of big donors and real shrewd politicians. If you put them in a room, and let's say they're Democrats here, they cannot look at each other in the eye and say, we can win this for Biden. I don't think anybody can really say that. So they're going to get into a room and they're going to find some way to move Joe Biden out. I don't know. It's not going to be easy because I think they have to move him out and her out, because if Gavin Newsom is coming along as the possible candidate, you can't have two people from California on the same ticket. So that sort of deals with the issue of what you do with her. Then, of course, the big question is, what do you do with her? Because I'm not so sure that Gavin Newsom is going to rally black support enough to overcome any loss of black support, primarily from women, that will happen if Kamala Harris gets dumped. So I also think, depending on how late it is, the one person that can write one check and not have a fundraiser is J.B. Pritzker. And again, I think he pales in comparison with the governor of California in a variety of ways, most notably cosmetically. But again, if you've got the money, you can pull it off.
Well, respectfully, I do think Governor Pritzker will be given a hand to whom to be replacing Kamala Harris on the ticket. And my number one guess from the Democrats would be Senator Duckworth. But also there are other congressional Democrats here that are making a name for themselves. Some of them are relatively young, like Lauren Underwood,
right?
Or Raja Krishnamurthy.
That's a
but
big
either
step,
way, just want to maybe Stephanie or the others, Mr. Dabrowski or the other gentleman can help out here too.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for your call. Appreciate it. Let's go to Eduardo, who listens tonight and joins us from Tampa, Florida. Nice to hear from Florida, Eduardo. Go ahead.
Yeah, Bruce, I was going to bring up Mr. Eric Johnson, not to be confused with, Mayor Johnson.
Brandon. The mayor of Dallas, Texas, who week announced he's leaving the Democratic Party and becoming a Republican.
Right, and he's emphasizing a strong police chief. Obviously, he's definitely somebody who supports the police, unlike some of the Democratic mayors around the nation, having a budget that reflects public safety. So I'm going to get your panel's reaction to that.
Let's go to Ted, because he's done some research on that your group at Wirepoints.
Yeah, I was fascinated when he recently spoke up about being pro-police and the way he talked about it. We did a back-and-forth, a reel, an Instagram reel, of Brandon Johnson versus Eric Johnson. And it's fascinating to hear two different languages, one that was serious about funding the police, one that was serious about arresting stopping crime, versus Brandon Johnson, who's done the opposite. Brandon Johnson is excusing crime, excusing criminals, and making a real mess of Illinois. So I think it's or Chicago. I think it's fantastic that what Eric Johnson has said and done.
Peter, do you agree with the assessment of Eric Johnson or Brandon Johnson that's been articulated?
I mean, I think frankly, it's really hard to get a very clear picture of the ROI on, policing at any given time. In CPD's case, I think the police budget for Chicago is more than $2 billion a year. I think it would be great to, take a look and make sure that all we're spending, we're getting back in terms of safety. But I live in the city. Bruce, you obviously spent a lot of time in the city. I think it's the same old story, whether it's Brandon Johnson or someone else. There are places in the city that there's money and investment and care, and crime is very low there. And then there are places that there isn't money, there isn't investment, and there isn't really any care, and crime is very high there. Where there is tons and tons of unmet need, there's more and more crime. So I think, the state of policing, the level of policing is kind of secondary to the circumstances on the ground. Why do you have areas that are unsafe? Why do you have areas that are so high crime? And then other areas where, the worst that'll happen is, an instance of shoplifting. Not to say that that's, to be condoned, but that has less to do with police presence and much more to do with actual investment and money in the area.
Mm-hmm. Amongst your progressive friends, how much do they talk about crime? Do they talk about it more so than they did 2 years ago, Peter?
I can't speak for my progressive friends, but no, not really at all more or less. I think the focus is rightly on sort of why there is crime. Why, when the police budgets steadily go up year after year, and again, we're spending $2+ billion in just the city of Chicago on police, why does crime increase, if we're actually investing more and more in law enforcement?
Well, one of the real challenges, which we will deal with in our second hour, with our guest, Todd Bestman, who's author of a book called Overrun, How Joe Biden Unleashed the Greatest Border Crisis in U.S. History, is what many large cities, including Chicago, are dealing with, and that is the thousands of people, immigrants, illegal immigrants, asylum seekers, who are coming to Chicago and looking for a place to stay. In Chicago, we're talking about building tents. The Cook County Board, which includes Chicago, they're talking about buying hotels where the illegal immigrants can stay. And we're going to talk about that in the second hour to find out what's happening in Chicago, because what's happening in Chicago is happening in large and mid-sized cities all over the United States. It isn't just a Texas issue anymore. We'll talk about that for a full hour in the next hour of Beyond the Beltway, from coast to coast and border to border, every Sunday night at beyondthebeltway.com. Thanks for joining us tonight. Good evening, everyone. This is Bruce Dumont. We continue with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway, and joining us as our special guest in this hour, we welcome Todd Bestman. He is an immigration investigator. He is author of a new book called Overrun, How Joe Biden Unleashed the Greatest Border Crisis in U.S. History. And we continue here in the studio with Stephanie Hitt and Ted Dabrowski, and also with Peter Hanna. They'll chime in with some questions as well, but Let me begin to you with you, Mr. Bestman, because when we spoke earlier today, you shared a piece of information with me that you have shared with your within your journalistic sphere of influence, some rather shocking news about things that are happening with illegal immigrants that don't have it hasn't been widely spread in a journalistic way. So what's the big shocking news you can share with us tonight?
Well, shocking to some, maybe not to others, is that the Biden administration for the last 8 months has been flying or approving for flight, rather, hundreds of thousands of immigrants while they're still in foreign countries south of even Mexico. Looks like 221,000 they've flown into, they've allowed to fly into 43 different airports across the United States. This information comes to us by way of a FOIA request that went into litigation with my organization. We're still litigating it, so we can't tell you which airports, because they still won't release which airports, but
Do you know what's happening? What is happening to them in these countries of departure? Are they being fingerprinted? Are they being vetted in any way? What's happening there before they get on these planes to the United States?
Well, they are required to enter their names and triangulation photographs, which is a biometric, into the CBP1 cell phone app, which is sort of a relatively new administration management system to keep people from crossing by just having them make an appointment to meet CBP or officers at ports of entry, either in the interior of the country or at the land ports, so that their numbers don't tally with the illegal entrance, and they can say, well, the numbers are down of illegal entrance, but they're not releasing the total numbers that are going through the cell phone app.
Are these asylum seekers or are they illegal immigrants?
Well, they're all intending border crossers. They intended to cross the border. A lot of them get in line for the CBP1 benefit, but then they don't follow through. They just figure, well, we'll just cross illegally anyway because it's quicker. So huge numbers are just kind of blowing off the CBP1 app, but there's still a lot that are using it. When we talk about vetting, it's important to know that the nationalities of people that are using these systems to, you know, put their biometrics in and whatnot, we're not really able to vet them because, like, we don't have a good enough relationship with the government of Venezuela, for example, to ask for an intel share or at least reports, or for Cuba, which is another huge number, and also Nicaragua, you know, the Ortega regime there. We're not friends with them either.
But when they get on that plane, do they know where they are going in the United States? And is there any advance warning to the municipalities that they're going to that a plane load of people are coming to their city?
No, the entire program is probably one of the most tightly kept state secrets of the administration. We are having to, you know, litigate for those numbers, and it's not easy litigation either. It's been dragged out and dragged out. I don't even know when we're going to get the total request that we asked for. The people of Chicago, for example, they're just familiar with people that are taking buses in.
Right.
Oh my God, they're getting off of buses. But I can almost guarantee you that Chicago O'Hare Airport, that there have been tens of thousands landing there as well, quite unbeknownst to Chicago. I've been told with sources that Miami is another big one, and so is New York, JFK, many, many, many thousands flying into Miami and JFK and
when you say,
43 other.
When you say tens of thousands, that's a hell of a lot of airplanes. So I am shocked by that number that you mentioned. Certainly, you know, when I think of a bus, I think of a bus of 45 or 50 people. And by the way, we can say literally tonight, right now as I speak, in the city of Chicago, there are buses coming from unknown destinations that are coming to Chicago that are going to be dropped on the door of the city of Chicago and the county of Cook to deal with, to find a place for them to live tonight. I mean, that's how relevant this thing is. And you're with the Center for Immigration Reform, or Study, rather, so that we should mention your background. And as you look at this subject and you've studied it for a long time, is there an answer to this? Is there a political answer that can resolve this crisis, in your view, Todd?
Well, sure. We saw during the final year of the Trump administration, the numbers fall of apprehensions at the border fall to the lowest point that they had been in 45 years. Those numbers were at about in the 20 to 30,000 a month range when the Biden administration came in, primarily because of two or three policies. One was called Remain in Mexico, which means that the Border Patrol can pick up illegal immigrants and push them back into Mexico, where they have to wait for their asylum claims there the entire time. There's a 4 or 5 year backlog, so that's not the point. The point of the system is that you get to wait inside the U.S. and win, lose, or draw, you just disappear. You know, if you win or if you lose or draw, you disappear. So nobody wanted to wait in Mexico. Nobody was coming for the great Mexican dream. And then there was another one called Safe Third Country, which said that, you know, Hondurans that crossed through Guatemala and Mexico and didn't apply for asylum there were then automatically deemed ineligible at the U.S. border. And so, you know, that wasn't good. And then finally they put in Let me just
stop one thing, because the way it used to be is that if you're from another country, it's the first country that you set your feet in where you're supposed to deal with your immigration issues. So the people that were going to Mexico, they were not processed by Mexico or a Mexican government, and then they just waved them to the U.S. border. Is that correct? I need a quick answer to that, because we're going to a break.
No.
Okay, I'm gonna let you correct my mistake when we come back. We're going to a break. We will hear from our other guests as well. 1-800-723-8289. When we come back, Todd is gonna correct my mistake.
commission.
Mr. Dumont, we are back, and I want to go to Todd Bestman again. Todd, I mis-summarized something before the break, and I want you to correct me. Go ahead.
Totally not a big deal. You know, most people don't know that kind of down-in-the-weeds material, but the issue at hand was that there was a policy that in the Trump era that if you crossed through a country that was regarded as safe and did not apply for asylum, you were ineligible to apply at the U.S. border. That actually, the asylum law, the U.S. asylum law as it stands right now, doesn't address whether you could have applied or that you already did apply. And in fact, many, many hundreds of thousands of people that have crossed into the U.S. and applied for asylum already did have asylum in multitudes of other countries for many, many years. Mm-hmm. It just that our law doesn't bar you from applying for U.S. asylum. It's one of the things that we think that needs to be tweaked, I guess, in that law. Now, Europe has one.
Mm-hmm. So last week on this program, we did a couple of hours, and we talked about and tried to separate and identify those who are illegal immigrants from those that are asylum seekers, and mentioning that if you are an asylum seeker, you are not breaking U.S. law. You're waiting for a judge to basically sign off on your case, and that could take 4 to 6 years to happen. If you are an illegal immigrant, it's completely different. There are some benefits that are available for an asylum seeker, and those benefits are not necessarily, in fact, they're not available to illegal immigrants, but local municipalities can basically make their own rules on this. Peter, I know you're our legal expert this evening, and I want to get your reaction to what you've heard thus far, and what solution would you offer to this crisis?
Yeah, wow, well, it's a lot of questions.
Yeah.
I would just start by saying that Biden's asylum policy, not even a month ago in early October, a Ninth Circuit panel of judges, one of the judges said pretty plainly the Biden's administration of what it calls pathways rule isn't meaningfully different from that of the previous administration. The Biden administration was fighting to maintain this in court, and the judge described the current rule as a combination of the Trump era point of entry rule and transit rule, which are basically the things that require people to either pass through a different country. They can't enter America illegally and seek asylum. They have to pass through a safe harbor country and seek asylum and prove that they did so first and then enter illegally. So it's not a meaningfully different thing, what the Biden administration is doing and what the Trump administration did. Not really. The Biden administration had a lower court declare that its approach, which was a holdover of the Trump approach, could not proceed. But this Ninth Circuit panel actually just said, no, it can proceed. So we're back to the Trump-era asylum approach. I think at the same time, I'd want to ask the guest at the end if his numbers include the number of flights. You know, how many of those people are unaccompanied minors, for example? Because unaccompanied minor crossings increased most dramatically very recently. And by law, this was a bipartisan decision, by law, when an unaccompanied minor enters the country, the government has to take care of them or find them housing or find them some sort of accommodations. And a lot of those flights are from the border inward. And I know that DHS also had a plan last year called the Abbott Plan. That's what they called it jokingly internally, about kind of easing the tension at the borders by flying people into the center of the country. I'd want to know if sort of that's something that you thought about or you have those like numbers sort of split up.
Let's let him answer the first two and then we'll go back to you for the third question.
I was answering your third part, Bruce, but I'm happy to let the guests proceed.
Okay, very good. Go ahead, guests. Todd.
So first of all, I'm going to have to ask your help in advance to manage those questions so I can remember. But to your question, to your first question, it is true that the Biden administration just implemented a plan, a safe third country plan, just like the Trump one. But the big difference is that we can find no evidence whatsoever that it's being used.
We have now
the Trump administration actually used it, but there is no evidence to date that the Biden, in fact, the evidence is quite the contrary. They're not using it. We have filed a FOIA request for the number of times that they've actually used that. I think the number probably would be close to zero. I might even be have a paycheck on it. Help me with the second question.
Oh, yeah. Just those flights that you mentioned, I was curious how many of those.
Unaccompanied minors.
Yeah.
So I did ask for a demographic breakdown of those flights, but they withheld that. I don't think, and we are still litigating that, but I don't think that that's how unaccompanied minors are being flown. There were unaccompanied minor flights internally inside the United States, like, you know, from border states to Chicago or, you know, but those are different. That's something completely different.
Ted Dabrowski has a question for you as well, as does Stephanie Hitz. Ted?
Well, I have a very simple one. You know, you hear people like Governor Pritzker in Illinois and some others complain about Abbott, complain about DeSantis sending the buses up. I haven't heard anything about Governor Pritzker complaining. I don't know who he'd complain to. I guess it would be Biden for his policy to allow airplanes to fly into O'Hare. And should we expect to hear from Pritzker? I know the answer, but should we expect to hear from Pritzker complaining about Biden?
Yeah, I don't. I mean, one thing about the I can say I live in Texas and I've been following the border for a long time. The bus operation, Abbott's bus operation, that's voluntary. Everybody that steps foot on that bus is really just taking advantage of a free ticket. Had Abbott not provided those buses, he's not putting them on buses. Nobody's forcing them onto buses. In fact, they all sign a waiver saying, I am doing this voluntarily. They were going to go anyway. They're saving a $200 bus fare, and that's why they're doing it. But I also would say that the immigrants were going to all of these cities by their tens of thousands long before, 18 months, 2 years before Biden ever even put – I mean, I'm sorry, Biden, Abbott ever – there's lots of B's – before Abbott ever put a single bus on the road. Same with DeSantis. They were complaining in New York. The schools were being overcrowded many, many months before any of this busing stuff happened. So I think there's a little bit too much onus on this busing stunt thing.
I think, and I've said it on this program, I think Governor Abbott of Texas should get some medal because what he has done with his decisions has basically said to the political leadership around the country who have all articulated a welcoming city rhetoric, it's basically put up or shut up. And he's called their game. And again, it should not be the responsibility of one state to deal with this national issue. So I congratulate the governor of Texas for what he's doing. You know, we've dealt with this subject for many years on this program, and periodically we will have a Texas sheriff who will talk about what's happening to his or community. But again, you look what's happening in Eagle Pass, Texas, which I guess is where the real sieve is at the moment. I mean, no city can survive that, let alone Chicago or New York. And again, New York, obviously they've got a bully pulpit because they're New York. But again, you know, they do want to describe themselves as a welcoming city. Stephanie.
All right. I have two questions, Todd. One is, these airplane flights coming from other countries, who's flying these planes? Who's paying for them? Who's, you know, and how do these people get alerted? Oh, show up at the airport this day, this flight. So that's my first question.
Let's let him answer the first question.
And then I got a really good second one. So
okay.
Come back.
Go ahead.
Obviously, I'm challenged to keep track. But, so the original policy document released in October of 2022, which was when this program was launched, and then it was expanded in January, wow, says that the immigrants in their other countries will apply for a travel authorization while still in the country, their country, or an adopted country. And when they get the approval, then it's on them to purchase a commercial airline ticket. So I'm assuming that they're paying for their own airfare, or, you know, maybe there's something, you know, like a pass-through money where they get reimbursed, mm-hmm, by somebody later, you know, but it seems like they're paying for it. They're required to pay for it on their own out of their own pocket.
Well, that's good.
Right. Well, that's a little bit. Okay, that, so my next question.
That's one of the best ideas I've heard so far.
And we can talk about it. And is it going to be a trend around the country? And that is the development. There's the, 60-mile development in Texas that people are building to basically create these little illegal immigrant towns. What is the name of it? Colony Heights?
Well, you're referring to a rather unique community in Liberty County, Texas. It's been there for 10 years, but it is absolutely booming right now. It has grown to 60 square miles in the forest lands of Old East Texas. Mostly illegal immigrants are said to live there. Federal law enforcement rarely goes in there, and it's very thinly patrolled, so it's regarded as a no-go zone of an illegal immigrant settlement, the largest in America.
Todd, we've got to break for a second. We'll be right back with our guests and the subject, illegal immigration, getting into the nitty-gritty tonight on Beyond the Beltway. Bruce Dumont back. We continue with our guest, Todd Bessman. He joins us. He's an immigration investigator. He's with the Center for Immigration Reform, and he is the author of Overrun, How Joe Biden Unleashed the Greatest Border Crisis in U.S. History. Ted Dabrowski joins us. He is with Wire Points, president of Wire Points in Chicago. Peter Hanna joins us. He is a professor and a materialist at Kent College of Law, and Republican commentator Stephanie Hitt joins us as well. Let me go back to you, Todd, to ask you, at this moment in time, you know, this story is changing every day. More and more people are knowing about it every day. It seems to me that one of the things that's changed in the last several months is that it isn't just Fox News that's talking about this. I'm seeing stories about this on ABC, NBC, and I don't watch much CBS, so I don't know whether they're doing it or not. Mm-hmm. But would you agree that maybe the awareness of these issues is greater today than it was 3 months ago?
Yes, and there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that the big inflection point in this crisis, the crisis is now almost 3 years old. Almost 5 million people are now in the country who had crossed the southern border. The big inflection point was the demise of a measure from the Trump era called Title 42. That was this instant pushback. Everybody who crosses gets pushed right back to Mexico, no asylum. That really drove down the numbers. The Biden administration kept part of it all the way up through May 12th. And when they decided to get rid of it once and for all, the intelligence community predicted that there would be anywhere from 10,000 a day to 18,000 a day, this really massive, really huge, massive number that nobody would be able to control. And instead of that happening, there was a pause at the border while the immigrants figured out, like, are they going to do mean things to us under the new policy? And that took about a month or two, and then they discovered that there is no negative consequence to crossing illegally at all. They were promising that Biden administration was promising that there would be very tough consequences. Like one of your other guests mentioned, you know, safe third country, all of these things, none of them are being used. And the world has discovered that if you come to the border, you're probably going to get in like at 99 percentile guaranteed. And so this incredible rush that the intelligence community predicted back in May, and the administration agreed with it, is happening now. It's just a little bit delayed. We're having 10,000 days, 14,000 days. Every center, processing center along the border is completely overwhelmed. They're having to just release people into the streets. It is an absolute chaos, and that is the, it's just the delayed prediction. I mean, they were, everybody was predicting this would happen. My organization and myself, we were just saying it's going to take a month or two and then it would happen. And that's just what's happening.
What, at this moment in time, if you want to come to the United States legally, what do you have to do and how long does it take if you want to do it legally?
Well, it just depends on what you're going for. I mean, there's tourist visas, there's you know, non-immigrant visas, and then there's immigrant visas.
Well, what if you want to come to the United States permanently? Permanently, what do you want to do?
It's not as fast, cheap, or easy as crossing the border. I can tell you that. No nation has a that simple, a cheap, easy way to get into the country to stay. So it depends on what you're going for, but it can be elaborate and take years and be pretty expensive to legally immigrate into the United States, which is why if you're going to let people in at the border en masse, like pretty much everybody gets in at the border, your legal immigration system just kind of collapses from neglect, you know, because what's the point, right? Why bother with the legal system if they're letting you in the illegal way just the same and you get to stay forever?
And if you, here's one other question. If you want to enter the United States and you want to claim asylum, what questions are asked? What are the legitimate reasons why someone can claim asylum and basically be granted entry into the United States?
Yeah, I mean, the quick, simple answer to that is it has to be government persecution on the basis of five criteria that include things like, you know, your political party or your sexual orientation or your tribal affiliation or nationality or race, those kinds of things, that you are being persecuted and that you're fleeing persecution, that you're coming over. The vast majority of these ones that are crossing into the United States are not fleeing anything like that, and they'll tell you that. I've interviewed thousands and thousands of interviews of immigrants that were on their way here, and nobody ever says about persecution. They just say, I'm trying to get a job and make some money. They're economic migrants. Most of them were living safely and prosperously in other countries that were not, like, nobody wants to live in Haiti. We all get that. But the vast majority of Haitians that are entering the United States have been living in Chile and Brazil for years and years with residency and asylum already. And they decided to come now because we were letting everybody in.
One last question that I have. We had a guest on this program last week, a longtime opponent of illegal immigration. And Roseanne Polito was her name. And she said that a lot of non-NGOs who work with them on as they come to the United States, a lot of them are basically giving briefs to the asylum seekers, telling them, coaching them on what to say to the asylum judge so they get in the United States. Have you seen any evidence of that, or do you think, I mean, the big question is how many of these people are lying through their teeth?
Well, the immigrants that I've interviewed over the years tell me that they get their information about how to lie on about asylum from other immigrants that got in successfully ahead of them. And they'll just, and it spreads around on social media. Here's what you need to say you know, tell them you're gay, or tell them that you know, a police officer was shaking your family down, or tell them. And so very often asylum officers will just get the exact same story over and over again, thousands and thousands of times, but they just kind of have to say, okay, we'll let you in and you can fight it out in court. And of course, nobody shows up to their court hearings, or very few do, because judges tend to say no. Once they do get in front of judges, judges turn down Guatemalans, for instance, you know, 85% of the time, 90%. Haitians almost never get asylum. So they don't bother going through with it. They just use the story to get past Border Patrol. And then after that, they just, come and get me. If a judge,
in this court process, this may be after many years, if a judge says to a, you know, Honduran, we do not grant you asylum, how does that Honduran get back to Honduras? Does he do it on his own recognizance, or is there a plane or bus waiting
right
for
out,
him?
Yeah.
Now, most just disappear and join the illegal immigrant population. That's why we've got 12 or 13 million illegally present people here, because they just say, come and get me. In the years that it will take for you to come and get me, I'll make a whole bunch of money. And that assumes that you'll ever come and get me. Because most of the time we can't. We have 6,000 ICE officers to track people down.
Stephanie's got a question.
All right. You know, as you describe this, there's clearly a system. There's a process. There's information. There's organization involved in all this. How much of that is run by cartels? I mean, let's be honest. I think a lot of Americans need to know and understand of the tens of thousands crossing our border every day. How much of that is literally cartel organization and activity? And are they running this whole process?
Well, the Mexican cartels control the exits from Mexico into the United States.
Okay.
Like physically control it under force of arms.
Like 100% of it?
Just the main crossing points, the popular areas where there's a lot of infrastructure for immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
The cartels will charge you to smuggle you across, or if you want to cross on your own, you have to pay a certain amount, like as a, toll to cross. But, in some cases, they're doing the smuggling all the way from Central America into the United States, and they'll charge, you know, $15,000 or $10,000 for those trips. But sometimes it's just, you know, give me $1,500 and I'll let you cross the river. So, I mean, it's really a gamut, but I wouldn't say that, that the cartels are responsible for bringing most of them in and across. They're just taking advantage. They're putting their sail up in the wind. And boy, is it a win. They're making billions and billions.
Yeah. They're getting a piece of the pie in some way for every person you see crossing that Rio Grande is probably paid off someone in the cartel somewhere in Mexico. We've got to continue. We are going to continue with our guests and get questions from our guests as well. For our guest, Todd Bestman, who joins us in hour number two. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight. Bruce Dumont back. It is our last segment, and we're going to go to Ted Dabrowski, who's got a question or comment.
Fantastic. Todd, thanks for all the answers you're giving. You know, one of the big concerns we all have also is kind of the social costs, the economic costs, and there's a lot of political costs as well that are going to be had. We don't know how it'll play out, but when you think about what's happening in Chicago, you've got this big, you know, Latino influx. You've got a black population that's saying, wait, what the heck is going on? And I want to give you a few stats. Unwed births in Chicago for blacks are at 82%. For Latinos, they're almost at 60%. Crime in Chicago, we've been the murder capital in terms of total number of homicides for 11 years in a row. You got crime, you got the education, you know, the black reading level in all of Chicago public schools, only one out of every 10 kids can read at grade level. And then you've got the jobs problem. We talked about that just a bit ago. Chicago black unemployment, the highest in the country. What the heck, you know, what should people be thinking, especially the Chicagoans, the people who are here, who are not happy with what's going on in Chicago. They're suffering. They're struggling. And here we go. We start doing all these different programs. We're rumored to spend over $1 billion on Medicaid alone for these illegal immigrants. So, you know, the resources are going to be troubled. Crime's a problem already. The jobs, the education, the unwed births. Talk to us about what you think the social costs are going to look like.
Todd?
Right. Well, I mean, this is a permanent, transformative event. We have experienced nothing like this in American history. We have had 5 million, close to 5 million illegal immigrants come into the country in 30 months. By the time the administration's first term or the term is over, it's probably going to be on the order of 7 or 8 million, especially at the new high rates that they're coming across now. Your city has seen nothing yet. You guys have seen nothing yet. It is just beginning. There are tens of thousands that are headed your way every single month. This is not going to end, and that's just by bus. I don't even know how many are flying in, and those are going to cost. I mean, there are going to be issues with – these are unfunded burdens. Nobody asked the voters of Chicago or the assembly to approve – funds for just this unexpected rush of humanity that are all needy. Nobody's insured. Very few of them speak English and have job skills. They're all going to have housing, food, clothing. They're going into your public schools. There is going to be crime that's associated with that population. There's no way around it. It's going to clog your criminal justice system. You know, listen, this is, I'm not talking about culturally, I'm just talking about fiscal costs, because those are pocketbook issues. I met yesterday in Washington, three of your leaders from the black community. I had lunch with them at an event yesterday. I'm in, back in Austin now, and they were telling me that the city just, approved a program where they're going to be providing each individual in a household, I haven't confirmed this. I'm telling you, I have not confirmed this, but that if you have four people in a household in an apartment, the city is going to provide $1,200 per person. So $4,600 a month for a family of four for 3 years straight. It's HUD money that's being passed through the state of Illinois. Passed through the city.
But the source on that, and, let's be clear. This is not verified, but who was the source for this verified information?
Three of your black leaders who I met in.
Do you know their names? Have you got their names?
Yeah, hold on. I've got their cards right here.
All right, good. We want to get their cards, and then Peter, I want to give you an opportunity, and Stephanie.
I don't know if I want to name them here.
What are you doing? Peter, you look like you're shaking your head. You want to make a – this will be probably a final comment or question?
Yeah, I guess, couple of – go ahead.
Go ahead, Todd.
Just to finish really quickly, they were telling me that, you know, a lot of those families are going to be living in housing in black areas of Chicago, black community areas. And that they're just – people are furious. They're hearing about this, and they're like, what about us?
But again, who were these people that said this to you, Todd? I mean, that's kind of an important piece of information if you had their cards there.
Yeah, I have one. Let me
Well, while Todd's looking at that,
I
heard that same conversation. Well,
say again. Do you have the names there?
Andre Barnes handed this to me yesterday. He lives in Chicago. He's a black leader there.
Don't know him.
And there were two others.
But he's
respond briefly?
Yes.
Yeah, so
Peter.
First off, you know, I don't see people as burdens. I don't see people who need something as needy. This is a country of immigrants. The bottom line is one question that's kind of missing in a lot of this of top scholarship is why? Why is this happening? Why are people fleeing one place and coming here? What is the cause of that? And it is instability largely the result of our activities in the Southern Hemisphere, in Central America. I mean, very disruptive in creating conditions where folks have not been able to have governments and not been able to seek prosperity. So, you know, in a lot of ways, when I see some of the migrant problem occurring, I can't shake the feeling that it's the chickens coming home to roost. So why don't we change our policies in a way so that there's less of a need for migrants to come, so that countries can, without, you know, having to worry about, you know, intervention, interference from the United States,
but also, I mean,
just begin to flourish.
Peter, that's obviously a very pessimistic interpretation. But again, the other thing is,
no, it's not pessimistic, Bruce.
Well,
it's realistic.
I didn't say it wasn't real. It's very pessimistic.
I have a good answer for you. A
quick answer.
That comes directly from the immigrants. I interview thousands of them. And I always ask them that. Why are you coming now? What news at the border did you hear that made you sell everything and come right now? And the answer overwhelmingly is they're letting us in. We're coming because they're letting us in. Everybody who goes there gets in. This is like never seen anything like this in their
life. Economic benefit. They're coming for the money.
Yeah. Let's do one thing. We've done a great job of promoting around the world that we're the greatest country in the world. We're at a point now, and we've discussed in the last 2 hours on this program, we've discussed an issue that really raises and challenges that challenge that we have. So we thank you very much, Todd. I hope you'll come back and join us again, our other guests as well. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks to Fritz Coleman. Good night.